From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition, Boy George, the 80s pop star who wore more makeup than Elizabeth Taylor, has reunited with his old band, Culture Club. Also, an interview with Hubert Selby Jr., author of the 1964 classic urban novel Last Exit to Brooklyn, about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. Selby has a new novel coming out this month. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews music by Maria Callas, reissued on the 20th anniversary of her death. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the movie version of The X-Files. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iowa Governor Terry Branstad has added two more counties to the list of disaster areas. Torrential rains have plagued the state for the past 2 days. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
People here are clearing debris and bailing water under a sunny sky today after powerful storms dumped almost 4 inches of rain on central Iowa in about an hour yesterday. Yes. It was Des Moines' worst flash flooding in recent history. Brad Small with the National Weather Service in Des Moines says the immediate forecast is encouraging.
Through the beginning of the weekend, it looks like we'll have warm temperatures, which will be good for drying, and pretty breezy too, and only a small chance of rain.
Rain is back in the forecast Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. Hydrologists say that will certainly cause more flooding as saturated ground is unable to absorb any more water, so the rain will run straight to flood-swollen rivers. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Des Moines.
American officials are hopeful after today's talks between a Treasury official and Japanese officials in Tokyo. U.S. Deputy Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers says his session today with Japan's finance minister was very good. Both said they are pleased with the U.S. effort this week to intervene in currency markets to support the sagging Japanese yen. And the leaders say they'll intervene again if necessary. However, American officials warn they want to see more than good intentions from Japan. They want to see action. The Clinton administration is accusing some members of Congress who want to cut trade ties with China of isolationism. UPI's Don Folsom reports.
Mike McCurry uses the term in defending President Clinton's claim that U.S. policies toward China pit those who, like Clinton, favor engagement against those in Congress who support isolationism. And he charges that those in Congress who oppose granting most favored nation status to China are wearing the isolationist blinders. The spokesman adds that such lawmakers are advocating the use of what he calls the thermonuclear device of economic diplomacy. McCurry says that to use trade as a penalty or to compel certain kinds of behavior is a very risky thing to do. Don Folsom, The White House.
Author and spiritualist Carlos Castaneda has died. His attorney says Castaneda actually died on April 27th in California of liver cancer. He was believed to be at least 66. The lawyer says Castaneda's cremated remains have been taken to Mexico. He wrote 10 books and claimed to follow an Indian sorcerer named Don Juan who could alter time and space. Critics doubted Don Juan's existence, but Castaneda insisted he met Don Juan in Arizona during the early 60s while researching medicinal plants. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 44 points at 8,768. The Nasdaq is up 5. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, it's shaping up as a busy day on the financial markets. That's because today is the once-a-quarter event dubbed as Triple Witching Day. NPR's Jack Spear explains.
Basically, what's happening on Wall Street today is the simultaneous expiration of options and futures on stock indices, known as triple witching. It's nothing to be afraid of, but it does mean quite a few portfolio managers are busy restructuring their clients' portfolios today. The stock market is also keeping close eye on this weekend's visit to Japan by Deputy U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, waiting to see what further actions the country will take to pull itself out of its current economic mess. And a short while ago, the European Union antitrust panel announced it has recommended clearance of the merger between WorldCom and MCI. That has provided MCI sells its internet business. That's according to industry sources. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Job cuts are on the way at a pair of key high-technology companies. Texas Instruments will cut nearly 8% of its payroll as it sells its memory chip business to Micron Technology. And disk drive maker Omega will cut up to 700 jobs as it anticipates big quarterly losses. Boeing says it'll lose orders for about 90 aircraft over the next 5 years because of the Asian economic crisis. The company says some of the weaker Asian economies will enter recessions lasting 12 to 18 months. Don't look for the NBA champion Chicago Bulls to make an appearance on your breakfast table. Without explanation, Kellogg and the NBA have scrapped plans to issue a picture of the Bulls on boxes of cornflakes. Bulls superstar Michael Jordan is a pitchman for rival Wheaties. Again on Wall Street, the Dow's down 44 points. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, where imaginations can run wild. Over 200 locations nationwide. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The British singer Boy George was a pop star in the 80s. With his band Culture Club, he had such hits as Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, Karma Chameleon, and I'll Tumble For You. His music was somewhere between pop, soul, and reggae. His look was somewhere between male and female. Culture Club fell apart in 1986, and so did Boy George, who was trying to kick a heroin habit. He cleaned up, but didn't reestablish himself in the States until the film The Crying Game. His version of the title song ran under the closed credits. In 1995, he published an autobiography called Take It Like a Man, and he released a CD called Cheapness and Beauty, his first to feature songs with an unambiguously gay point of view. Culture Club has reunited. They just performed in London, and they begin an American tour in July. Also next month, a new Culture Club compilation CD will be released. On this archive edition, we have a 1995 interview with Boy George. Let's start with the Culture Club hit, I'll Tumble For You. To sing songs now that acknowledge that you're gay?
Well, I guess all my songs have, in a way, been sort of gay love songs in a sense. In the past, they were kind of ambiguous.
I'm trying to think, you know, in your lyrics in the past, was it always like a you instead of a she or a she or a he that you were addressing?
I think it was general, you know, we kept it ambiguous. The first time I ever recorded with Culture Club, the first demos we ever made, or for EMI Records, mm-hmm. and a song called Eyes of Medusa was one of our first songs. And in that, I sang He Loves Me, He Hates Me. And there was a whole incident where the engineer stopped me and said, you're saying he. And then the whole band had a big discussion about it. And we decided that it would be better to not alienate people. So in a way, what I've done is gone back to my original way of writing and just written from the heart, really.
Now, let me explain. I'm in a studio in Philadelphia. You're in a studio in New York. We're connected by wires, so I'm not seeing you. What's your look now?
It's kind of Priscilla Presley meets Alice Cooper.
Why don't you describe what you're wearing, how your hair is?
Well, my hair's kind of like 60s with a bit of punk. And I have on fierce black eyeliner that kind of sweeps up towards the sky. And then I have kind of quite normal clothes. It's kind of casual with a twist. I have these kind of weird pants, which I bought in Japan. Kind of bright blue Versace boots, an orange check shirt, and a kind of grey jacket from Jean Paul Gaultier. Nothing too flamboyant, but it kind of has an edge to it.
What colour's your hair?
My hair is black, jet black. like a raven.
How come you dyed it black?
Well, let's not go into that. It's always been dark.
Boy, that's like the last thing I thought that he wouldn't want to talk about.
Well, you know, my hair kind of changes color daily as I take it in and out of the box.
Oh, I see. Right, okay.
It's like a kind of living Cindy doll approach.
Got it. Okay. You know, when I first saw you perform, I wasn't sure whether the drag was just a way to get attention, you know, and you actually like went home and put on khakis and a shirt and tie, or whether, you know, you really enjoyed dressing in drag and always had.
Well, when I was a teenager, I started dressing up. When I discovered David Bowie, that was my kind of extravagant style began. In Culture Club, I did kind of look like that most of the time. These days, I'm more likely to go home and put on a pair of baggies, you know, because I like to have a distinction between what I do on stage. And there is more of a separation now than there used to be. I was kind of trapped in that image for years. I couldn't bear to let people see me looking normal. Now I don't give a damn.
What's changed for you that you don't care now?
I guess I'm more comfortable with my appearance, my physical appearance, without the armor, without the drag. So there's more of a balance, and it just makes dressing up more fun, you know, because it's not something you have to do as an obligation.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you into style before you were old enough to go to the clubs?
The first line in my book is, when I was a little boy, I wanted to be Shirley Bassey. So I've always been attracted to style and dramatic gestures. I grew up with a fascination for all things different. I used to watch those Busby Berkeley movies on the Saturday TV on Saturday, and I just always loved glamour and pizzazz.
And when did you start to try to become that?
I guess around the age of about 11 years old, when I started to really get into pop music. That was around the time of the glam scene.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people like David Bowie, Mark Bolan, all sorts of fantastic performers, and that's when I really started getting into it.
Now, when did you start to sing?
Well, I always used to sing along to pop records. I used to walk around the streets with a transistor radio to my ear, and I learned all the words to every pop song you could imagine. So I was always singing all my childhood and all through my teenage years. And people used to say, you know, you have a good voice. Why don't you try and become a singer? But it just seemed so out of reach when I was a teenager. And when punk rock came along, it really opened the door for people like me, because prior to that, you really had to pay your dues and spend years on the road. And punk kind of kicked down the door and turned everything upside down.
So what was your singing like when, you know, during the punk era?
Well, my first band was called In Praise of Lemmings. So it kind of gives you an idea of what kind of... And we had this song, which was called Mask. And it was I was really influenced by Susie and the Banshees. I was a big Susie Banshee fan. So it was kind of very droney, kind of make a mask for me, all that kind of deep baritone type stuff, and very suicidal. But I soon snapped out of that.
Tell us the story of how Culture Club got started.
Well, I was in this band called Bow Wow Wow, and they threw me out. But I had the bug. I'd been on stage, I'd gotten a kind of taste of it. So I started to look for my own band. And that's really how it happened. I just rang around. And then once I got a couple of members of the band, we started to look for other people.
So one of the co-founders of the band, John Morris, who you know, was the drummer, you were lovers with him for a long time.
We were lovers pretty soon after we met. John was the kind of driving force behind the band, you know, getting things organized. He was a real sort of go-getter type person. So he was the kind of practical force within the band.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of fell in love within about 3 months of meeting each other. And that's really what made the whole thing so exciting. But as we got more and more successful, our relationship kind of fell apart. You know, the pressures of being successful and jealousy, immaturity. I mean, it really kind of wore us down.
In your book, you say that you actually wanted people to know that you were gay, but John didn't want you to reveal that.
Well, John didn't want people to know about us,
mm-hmm,
and our relationship, because on the one hand, he felt that the media, if they knew, might try to interfere and write bad things about us. And I guess also there was a lot of fear on John's part because he wasn't very comfortable with his sexuality. But as far as I was concerned, you know, I was out of the closet at 16. My parents knew when I was 16 years old. So it was very frustrating for me to be kind of living in limbo, almost living a lie. I mean, obviously, the way I looked and the way that I behaved, I think made it quite clear to a lot of people what I was. But I was sitting on the fence, and it was a very difficult thing for me to do.
What advice did your record company give you when you signed?
My record company never, ever gave me any advice about my sexuality. Nobody ever interfered. I think people don't want to talk about it. The general attitude in the business is they'd rather not know. You know, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. I mean, I never had any of that. I mean, no one in my management or in my record company ever said, you know, don't say. They just didn't talk about it.
Let me play the record that was your first hit in the States. Was it, I'm going to play Do You Really Want to Hurt Me. Was that your first hit in England also?
It was our third single, but it was our first successful record.
Do you want to say anything about writing the song, how you feel about it now?
Well, I guess in those days, I was a bit of a victim. And this song is very kind of woe is me. You know, it was a song about John, all about the fact that, you know, he wasn't sort of giving 100% to the relationship and he wasn't being honest with himself. So I guess it has a certain poignancy.
Okay, this is Boy George, Culture Club, singing Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, the first hit in the States.
Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Lovers never ask you why. In my heart the fire's burning. Choose my color, find a star. Precious people always tell me that's a step too far.
I thought it was interesting in your book, you say that at some point you realize that all the fans that surrounded your house and that really wanted to get close to you, it wasn't so much that they cared about you, they cared about being close to fame, being close to celebrity.
Well, I can only kind of relate it to my own experiences as a teenager. You know, I used to stand outside David Bowie's house and I used to go to radio stations and I used to touch him as he, you know, I used to try and touch him and scream as he came out of the building. I don't really know why I did that. When I think about it now, I think how ridiculous. But I guess in some way I related to David Bowie. He was somebody a little weird. He was bisexual. I knew I was gay. So he was kind of like a god to me. He was a kind of release and escape. I don't know if that's true of my fans, but I think a lot of the girls that were kind of into Culture Club and into me, I think they really recognized a certain frailty and a certain vulnerability in me, and I think that was what was the attraction.
My guest is Boy George. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Boy George. You write in your book that you became trapped in your own image. You had a lot of different styles before you really became famous. Was the image that you had when you became famous one that you were expected to keep?
Well, I don't think I was expected to keep it.
I mean, were you expected to keep, like, that hairdo and that outfit?
Well, it kind of worked. So it was, I mean, the look that I had in Culture Club was a kind of watered down look of all the looks I'd had since I was a teenager.
Describe it.
Well, it was the big Hasidic hat.
I never thought of it that way.
Well, it was actually a proper Jewish hat that I wore.
Really?
Which was a present from John. It was actually a Frummer's hat.
Huh.
And then I wore it with sort of dreadlock braids with ribbons.
Uh-huh.
And my clothes were kind of psychedelic and baggy. not really women's clothes, kind of blurring the boundaries. I mean, kind of androgynous, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't wear breasts. I wasn't really trying to be a woman. I was really contradicting all those sort of rigid ideas of what is male and female.
What about the image of the rest of the band?
Oh, I did terrible things to them. I mean, I made them wear things that they looked absolutely ridiculous in. Once I made Roy have white dreadlocks, which was a pretty hideous look. And then there was a time in Japan when I made them all wear these kind of very tight sort of lycra shorts with clip-on suspenders. That wasn't a particular favourite look of theirs. I was very bossy. I mean, I used to... I guess because they were kind of quite straight-laced, so I used to try and spice them up a bit and make them look more interesting.
Mm-hmm. When you came to America... And you had become a star here, and you started doing television shows here, shows that you didn't know. It must have been an interesting experience. Like, in your book, you write about being on Live with Regis Philbin, and what a disorienting experience that was. Would you tell us about that?
Well, when we arrived at the show, I couldn't believe that all the audience were wearing flared trousers and wide lapel jackets and big, funky collared shirts, you know, and we looked like space aliens. It was, like, so bizarre because we seemed, like, to be from another planet.
You know, he's got a wildly popular show now.
Absolutely, yeah.
Are you going to... You want it?
I did it this morning.
Did you? Now, you did Solid Gold. And I thought it was really interesting. You wouldn't let the Solid Gold dancers share the stage with you because why?
I thought they were tacky, to be honest with you.
Well, I have to agree with you.
I mean, I felt that the whole setup of Solid Gold was a bit 70s, and we were... all about doing something modern, something revolutionary. And I just thought that they jarred with our image.
So were you really had the power to say, sorry, you can't use your own dancers on the show?
Well, I said you can use them, but just not behind us, thank you.
So,
I was a bit of a tyrant in those days. I mean, I used to really, I used to pull weight a lot. You know, I used to really get, you know, very uppity about things, and I would refuse to do the show. I would just simply say, well, if they're on, we're not, you know. And, of course, I got away with it a lot of the time.
One year when you won a Grammy, you said, well, why don't you repeat what you said?
I said, thank you, America. You got style and taste, and you know a good drag queen when you see one.
Now, how did you decide to say that?
It just kind of flew out of my mouth. I mean, it wasn't like I sat down and planned to say it.
Oh, you hadn't?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, a lot of the things I say... kind of just burst out, you know. And I remember after that, I was told that a lot of the people from CBS Records, who I was signed to at that time, had fallen off their chairs and were, like, weeping and, you know, kind of dying in shock on the floor. So I was quite pleased about that.
Did they say anything to you afterwards?
Well, I think that up until that point, and I say this in the book, up until that point, my sexuality had been kind of hovering in a huge question mark. And by saying I was a drag queen, I was kind of saying I was gay. So it really did change things for me after that. I mean, it kind of signaled a kind of almost like, you know, it was like almost like the end of Culture Club. Because people had always wanted to see me as this kind of sexless, inoffensive, exotic doll. And suddenly I was sort of being sexual and being provocative. And it really freaked people out.
So did it change your audience's reaction to you?
Well, I did hear that there were kind of college debates about what I actually meant. You know, people did take it far more seriously than it was, you know, than was necessary. But I guess in those days, you know, it was quite a shocking thing. I mean, mm-hmm. Now you have drag queens on every kind of, you know, movie you can see, and they're on TV all the time. But at that time, I suppose people found that shocking, you know.
You started using drugs after the band caught on. How did it change your personality when you got involved with heroin?
Well, I think drugs really help you to escape. And a drug like heroin is almost like a womb-like drug, you know. You just completely cut off from your feelings. You don't care about anybody or anything. And you almost have this kind of superior air about you that is, you know, it's hard to imagine unless you've done it.
You know, in your book, you say that on tours you got into, you know, destroying expensive hotel rooms.
No, never.
Oh, that's what I thought it said. No,
no, never did anything like that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to get very upset watching Laurel and Hardy bust up these houses. It used to really upset me. I would never, ever do anything like that. I mean, that's something, I guess, you know, coming from a quite poor family, you know, my mother really had to kind of scrape mm-hmm. to get by. And she was very house proud, so I would never, ever bust up a hotel.
I'm really
ever.
Glad. I just think it's so spoiled to do that.
I hate it
when rock stars do that.
Oh, no, I've never done that. Oh, no, not me. Ozzy Osbourne, but not me.
How did you end up kicking heroin?
Well, unfortunately, I lost two very close friends of mine. And that was a real sharp shock. Because I realised if I carried on, I'd be next. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, I had the world's media on my back. I felt like almost like a rat in a corner. You know, I really didn't have any choice because everybody was saying, please give up, you know, pull yourself together. And as I say, you know, losing my friend Michael and my friend Mark was really what I needed. And I'm sad to say that, you know, because, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of them, you know, mm-hmm. and wish I could turn back the clock, wish I could have done something, you know.
Boy George, recorded in 1995. He's reunited with his band Culture Club. They begin an American tour next month, which will coincide with the release of a Culture Club compilation CD. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up from the archives, Hubert Selby talks about his classic urban novel from 1964, Last Exit to Brooklyn. He has a new novel coming out this month. TV critic Deva Bianculli reviews the movie version of The X-Files, and Lloyd Schwartz reviews music by Maria Callas, reissued 20 years after her death. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 20 years since the death of soprano Maria Callas, but she's never been more popular. Live performances, home videos, and even a CD-ROM of her Tosca are now available. EMI has been reissuing all of her complete operas and vocal recital albums in better sound. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, is surprised only at the rare coincidence between popularity and artistic greatness. Here's his review.
A few months ago, I was watching Seinfeld, and there was a commercial for Apple Computers. "Think different," the slogan read, and flashing across the screen were images of Einstein, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Picasso, and Maria Callas. Think different. She certainly did. And those differences made her the greatest and, of course, the most controversial opera singer of the century. One of the controversies was over her voice, which was not conventionally beautiful and not particularly large. But it had color, a different color and character for each part she played. Dark and ferocious for Turandot or Lady Macbeth. Light and lambent for the witty comic heroines of Rossini. Frail and pathetic for Violetta or Mimi. Ferocious and pathetic for Medea or Norma. At the beginning of her career, Callas astonished the opera world by singing Wagner's heroic Brunhilde and the brilliant vocal filigree of Bellini in the same week. And within each role, no one was ever more expressive in coloring the words. Her recitatives are at least as interesting as her arias. She seemed to live her roles, speak them while she was singing. Yet no singer ever hewed more closely to a score. "Callas is Carmen," the ads read when she recorded Bizet's opera. And for once, the ads were true. And not only words, Callas changed the 20th century perception of a lost style of 19th century opera called bel canto by demonstrating that all those wordless vocal ornamentations were part of the drama. Lucia's coloratura trills and roulades, unarticulated notes, became with Callas the most poignant expression of Lucia's madness, a source not just of visceral vocal excitement, and it was certainly exciting, but of profound human pathos. It's that astonishing flexibility and her refusal to sing anything less than all out, even in rehearsal, that may have caused her voice to wear out so quickly. The greatest part of her career lasted little more than a decade. Still, she continued to record, and then, even with her voice fraying, she learned to make her problems part of the drama, to add even greater subtlety to her phrasing and depth to her characterizations.
Mi fece in giù.
No operatic career has ever been more fully documented on disc. There's now a 4-CD set called Callas, The Voice, The Story, that includes interviews with Callas and other musicians and substantial excerpts from live performances. But there's little Callas on film. One treasure that has just been added to her videography is the aria Vici d'Arte from Tosca that she did on The Ed Sullivan Show. It's on a video called Great Moments in Opera and is the only extant film record of Callas at the very height of her power, and she's shattering. The most important news, however, is that EMI has been reissuing all her recordings in improved sound. And her recital albums are now organized as they were on their original LPs. They're short discs, but at bargain prices, and it's revealing to hear each album as the unified statement it was first intended to be. Perhaps Callas's continuing popularity results from the non-musical side of her life, the drama of the artist with convictions confronting the arbitrary authority of opera managers, and the juicy gossip of her lawsuits, her weight loss, her feuds, her public quarrels with her mother, how she left her husband for Aristotle Onassis, how Onassis dumped her for Jackie Kennedy. Trash. What's important is that she was a great artist, a creative genius, the Einstein, the Picasso of opera. But if the trash lures a new public to recognize her genius, then bravo to the trash.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The Maria Callas recordings he reviewed were reissued by EMI. Coming up, Hubert Selby Jr. talks about writing his classic urban novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn. This is Fresh Air. Hubert Selby Jr. has a new novel called The Willow Tree, which will be published later this month. On this archive edition, we have a 1988 interview with him. Selby is best known for his 1964 novel, Last Exit to Brooklyn, about hoodlums, hookers, drug addicts, and transvestites. When we spoke, the movie adaptation was in production. The characters in the novel were brutal, their stories hopeless. Selby said he was trying to portray the horrors of a loveless world. Although the novel is now considered an urban classic, it was shocking and controversial when it was published. It was the subject of a major obscenity trial in England and was banned in Italy. In America, an editor was arrested for having published one of Selby's stories. Last Exit to Brooklyn is set in the slums around Brooklyn's waterfront, where Selby hung out in 1949.
Well, it was at the time as the New York port of embarkation. They used to call it the Brooklyn Army Base. And it subsequently has been closed, and it's now being turned into office space. But that operated all through the Second War and the Korean War. And tons of troops and material and equipment was shipped from the Army base overseas to Europe. And, of course, there was a lot of Navy personnel there as well. And it was like any neighborhood waterfront area. There was a lot of violence, just an incredible amount of violence.
I think one of the best-known characters from your novel is Georgette, who you describe as a hip queer. He's a homosexual, but often dresses in drag and is described as a she in the book. Who is the character based on?
Well, there was a young guy named Georgie that lived in the neighborhood, and I didn't understand my relationship to Georgie at the time, but I realized subsequently that I had a very deep and profound affection and compassion for Georgie, and in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing the book. And that came about to anticipate a question. I wrote the first part of a section of Last Exit called The Queen is Dead. I wrote the first part of that story, and I called it Love's Labor's Lost, and that was published in the Black Mountain Review. And a year or two later, I met someone from the neighborhood, and they said Georgie had been found dead in the streets, literally in the gutter, and evidently died of an OD. And as I said, I didn't understand the emotions behind this at the time, but I knew I had to finish the story. I could not allow Georgie to have died, especially such a humiliating death, without doing something for him. I had to give him I had to dignify his life in some way. And I mean dignify, not romanticize. And so I finished his story, and as I was doing that, the concept for the book developed. So in a very real way, Georgie was responsible for my writing Last Exit to Brooklyn. And when they suggested I play the role of the car driver in the movie that hits Georgette and kills her, it just seemed absolutely perfect for me because it seemed poetic, too, that I would be, in a sense, killing Georgie when I brought Georgie to life in the book and then subsequently on the screen, and that finally, hopefully, Georgie can be put to rest and find the dignity that all life deserves.
Did any readers assume that you were either gay or a transvestite after reading either the story, The Queen is Dead, or Last Exit to Brooklyn?
As I understand it, most people assumed I was gay. And also, a friend of mine told me a very interesting story. He was talking with a black friend of his, and he said that this friend of his assumed I was black because I had depicted black people so well. So I guess I'm a black, gay, homosexual queen or something.
I had heard from someone that your publishers wanted you to pose with your wife just so readers would know he's not a homosexual.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. I think somebody interviewed me and suggested that we do that, have a picture in whatever magazine that was. And if I remember correctly, I said, no, that gay people buy books. Let's not scare them off. I'd forgotten that. That's true.
So they went for that, huh?
Well, whatever. I mean, I don't know, but they went for it or not.
Hubert Selby Jr. is my guest, and I want to ask you, now that I'm reintroducing you by name, your nickname is Cubby.
Correct.
How did you get the name?
Well, I'm not sure, but when you have a name like Hubert, and you're... and you're playing on the streets of Brooklyn with Vinny and Mikey and Tony, and they look at and say, Hubert, Hubert. You have to do something to survive. And at one point when I was maybe 10 years old, or not area, someplace. I was on a team called the Bear Cubs. And the only connection I can see between the nickname Cubby and some event in my life is that. So maybe from that came the name Cubby. I don't know, but I am eternally grateful. And maybe the only reason I survived my childhood was eventually I got to be called Cubby instead of Hubert.
Hmm. How did you start to write? You dropped out of high school.
Well, I don't know if I went to high school.
Oh, really?
Well, I did finish the ninth grade. I guess that's high school.
My neighborhood, it was junior high.
Yeah, I know. But anyway, I left at 15. I started to write because I was taken off a ship in Germany when I was 18. They said I couldn't live more than 2 months. And I've been given up for dead many times. And I just didn't want to waste my life. I had what I now realize was a spiritual experience. And what happened was I knew that someday I would die. And just before I died, two things would happen. Number one, I would regret my entire life. And number two, I would want to live my life over again, and then I would die. And that terrified me. As I say, it was a spiritual experience. And you know, as you know, those experiences are far more profound than any experience we can have at this level of consciousness. And to think that I would live my entire life, look at it, and say, oh, I blew it, was such a terrifying thought that I bought a typewriter. I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I bought a typewriter because I had no ideas or anything else. But that is what got me to start writing, was I did not want to waste my life. I wanted to, and I had to do something with my life.
So you dropped out of school when you were 15 and you went to work on the waterfront. Why did you drop out?
I was as restless, irritable, and discontent. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't stand it. And I also knew I could never succeed in school. It terrified me. I knew I didn't have whatever it takes to go to school. And in many ways, that's true, I didn't. I couldn't do it. I had to go. I had to go.
So you went and you worked on the waterfront. What was the experience like for you, and were you exposed to the kind of violence and corruption that you've written about?
Not really. I wasn't. It was a job. You know, I worked on tugboats. I worked on launches. I worked on dredges, and then I went to sea on Liberty ships. And I wasn't exposed to it in that sense. And I loved it. I've always wanted to go to sea. If I hadn't gotten sick, I might still be going to sea. I just loved it. I loved everything about the water.
Well, when you were 18, you signed on to a freighter, and that's when you got tuberculosis, right?
Well, actually, I had been sailing on freighters for a couple of years at that point.
I see.
I started, I guess I was 15 or 16 the first time I sailed to Europe. And it was just after my 18th birthday when I was taken off the ship. In Germany.
With tuberculosis.
Correct.
Now, if I have this straight, the therapy that they used for you, because you were very sick, was the doctors deflated one lung, took out part of your other lung, and then removed 10 ribs. Why did they remove 10 ribs?
Well, they cut 8 ribs out on one side to collapse that lung permanently. And they cut a couple of ribs out on the other side to cut the piece out of the lung. And they had used an experimental drug to keep me alive, and that impaired my vision and my hearing, and my inner ear was almost totally destroyed, and I couldn't walk. I'd fall down, and all my muscles were petrified from the drug, so it was kind of a mess.
You got hooked on morphine from the hospitalization experience after the TB and the surgery?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any medical precautions that were taken, you know, so that you wouldn't get hooked?
Well, you can't prevent it, but, I didn't leave the hospital physically addicted. I just fell in love with the stuff when I got it in the hospital and eventually found it on the streets.
How did you kick?
Oh, it was really very simple. I got arrested, and they strapped me down in solitary, and I kicked my habit.
So you kicked in prison?
Not prison, just a jail, county jail.
Still must have been pretty excruciating.
Well, it was very unpleasant.
Was anybody kind to you while you were there?
Yeah, nobody was unkind. Yeah, the system, of course, is a drag, but there was nobody was nasty to me or anything. And again, you know, I just kind of have a way of of finding the biggest, strongest murderer and becoming friends with him, and nobody bothers me.
Really? Is that the trick?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So what's the technique?
I'm not sure. It's just some inner thing of survival that allows me to kind of smile the right smile and talk the right talk. I have a way of knowing what goes on inside of people, and I can appeal to that.
Is this something that you've done not only in prison but outside of prison, you know, to kind of get the right protection?
Oh, well, not consciously always to get the protection, but to talk with people with their language about their life, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes people comfortable, and they respond. They respond to you.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Hubert Selby Jr. recorded in 1988. His new novel, The Willow Tree, will be published later this month. Coming up, The X-Files movie. This is Fresh Air. We sent our TV critic David Bianculli to the movies to see The X-Files Fight the Future. Here's his thoughts on the movie version of the popular TV series.
In order for an X-Files movie to work, it has to succeed on two levels at once. For people who have never seen the show, it has to stand alone on its own merits and establish the lead characters and primary subplots that fans of the series already know so well. For those fans of the series, it has to move the show's narrative story forward rather than start over from scratch, and also has to offer something new. The X-Files movie, with its screenplay by series creator Chris Carter, does both of those things well. It has other problems, which I'll get to in a minute, but it jumps those first two hurdles very impressively. When the TV series ended for the season, the X-Files department of the FBI had been disbanded, and agents Fox Mulder and Dana Scully, played by David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson, had been reassigned from investigating the paranormal to more routine duties. When we first see Mulder and Scully in the movie, they're performing some of those other duties, helping with a bomb threat called in on a Dallas federal building. These early scenes nicely establish the banter and trust between Scully and Mulder. And all of the exposition, explaining what drives and haunts the character of Mulder, is provided almost comically. It's done in a scene where he goes to a bar to drown his sorrows and spill his guts to the bartender, played by Glenn Headley. And when that bartender hears his story, she cuts off his liquor supply.
So, what do you do?
What do I do?
Mm-hmm.
I'm the key figure in an ongoing government charade, the plot to conceal the truth about the existence of extraterrestrials. It's a global conspiracy, actually, with key players in the highest levels of power, and that reaches down into the lives of every man, woman, and child on this planet. So, of course, no one believes me. I'm an annoyance to my superiors, a joke to my peers. They call me Spooky. Spooky Mulder, whose sister was abducted by aliens when he was just a kid and now chases after little green men with a badge and a gun, shouting to the heavens or anyone who will listen that the fix is in, that the sky is falling.
Well, I would say that about does it, Spooky.
New elements in this movie include Martin Landau as Mulder's latest source of top-secret government information and a new type of life form that is only partly human. But for X-Files loyalists, a lot of things in the movie will be reassuringly familiar. Mitch Pileggi's FBI assistant director Skinner is here, as are the sinister cigarette-smoking man, the wacky lone gunman, those conspiracy theorists who are even more paranoid than Mulder, and even killer bees and the mysterious black oil. Most of all, though, the film is about the two characters at its center, Scully and Mulder. And that's the smartest thing about this big movie version of The X-Files. Yes, the sets are bigger, and there are more explosions and car crashes, and the story spans more time and space than most TV episodes of The X-Files. And everybody gets to swear a lot. But what works best in this film is what works best on the small screen as well, the chemistry between the two leads. If you compare The X-Files Fight the Future to other summer action movies of the past few years, it comes off as being refreshingly intelligent. Rob Bauman, who directed the movie, has directed dozens of episodes of the TV series and manages to take advantage of the big sets and set pieces without forgetting to hone in on his stars. The two major problems I have with the film are lapses, one of logic, one of taste. The major logical lapse comes near the end, when a very obvious question about how Scully and Mulder escape from a remote and hostile environment is never answered. Instead, the movie avoids the question and merely fades to the next scene. What's much worse, though, is an early explosion that intentionally echoes, in visual terms, the Oklahoma City bombing. That's poor taste, pure and simple. The rest of the movie, though, is just fine. Special effects are strong, and there's a lot of mood and mystery in classic X-Files tradition. As for whether Scully and Mulder finally link up in this film in the romantic sense, well, if you're curious about the answer, then you probably want to discover it for yourself. Go to your local movie theater. The truth is out there.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air was produced this week by Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.